This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The super warming gas, methane, more than doubled in the atmosphere since 1750. Since 2007, methane is rising again, and it's steeply. It threatens to undo previous climate agreements and make the world much hotter sooner. Where is it coming from? Are we experiencing a methane emergency? Dr. Ewan Nisbet and his team lead the world in tracking methane. Under a UK program called MOIA, scientists in all corners of the world carefully capture flasks of air for Professor Nisbet's lab at Royal Holloway, University of London. Nisbet flies sampling aircraft over remote bogs in Africa, South America, and the Arctic. Add in satellite data, and a global methane picture emerges. From London, Ewan Nisbet, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, it's good to talk to you again. I'm sad that you're interested because it just means that something is going badly somewhere in the climate change world.
Well, definitely here in BC, we had a heat event where it almost got to 50 degrees C or over 120 degrees Fahrenheit. Hundreds of people died. People just were not prepared for it. We have hardly any air conditioning here. The village of Lytton burned down, you know all that. Do you think that an increase in methane could be a factor in such extreme heat events coming so soon?
I think every scientist you talk to will be extremely careful in ascribing particular events to particular things. So, any climate change scientist would be very, very concerned to ascribe any particular event to any particular cause. It's just too difficult. But what we do know is that the climate warming driven by the greenhouse gases, it's first of all very strong, and the recent Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report has shown just how strong it is. But it's growing very fast at the moment. And, you know, we've had the Rio and Kyoto processes going back to the 1980s, really. And yet the problem's getting worse, not better. The international negotiations have certainly helped. They've helped tremendously. It would be an awful lot worse. And we do have this one wonderful success, which is the Montreal Protocol on the ozone-depleting gases, which has also helped tremendously in the greenhouse gases. So there is a success. But in methane in particular, which I'm interested in, it's past 1,900 part per billion in the air, compared to about 700, 750 before humans started changing the air. It's way, way out, and we had the strongest growth in the observational record just in 2020, the last full year that we've got detailed record of. And, you know, its growth seems to be accelerating. So it's very scary indeed.
Well, seeing dangerous changes in the atmosphere, the Royal Society organized a discussion meeting about it for October 2020. That had to be called off because of the pandemic. Did you hold it in October 2021?
Yes, we did, online, unfortunately. And that's been published, and nearly all the papers are open access, so you can look at them, in two volumes of the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, which is actually the world's oldest scientific journal. Captain Cook, if you look back in 17-something, found out where Canada was in that. He located the longitude of Newfoundland by looking at an eclipse. So the Phil Trans Royal Society is a very old journal. And what we were looking at was the question is the warming feeding the warming? Much of the recent rise in methane has been apparently driven by biological sources. We're not absolutely sure, but the reason we say this is that for 200 years, from about 1750 right through to 2007, methane in the air was being progressively enriched in what we call carbon 13. Now, carbon has different forms. There's stable carbon 12, stable carbon 13, And then you've probably heard of carbon-14, which is radioactive and used by archaeologists to date things. But the carbon-12-13 ratio is a sort of isotopic signature. And methane that's emitted by biological sources tends to be a little richer in carbon-12, whereas methane that comes from fossil fuels tends to be a little richer in carbon-13. It's a bit more complex because some tropical grasses, and that includes maize and sugar, which are human foods, are also a bit up on the carbon-13. But if you've got the carbon isotopic ratios, and you know where you've sampled the methane, whether it's in the North Pole or somewhere in the equator, you can then ask yourself, where is all this new methane coming from? Now, methane only lasts in the air for about 9 years. That's its replacement time. And so there are obviously big new sources coming in, which seem to be biological sources, because the methane in the air is getting a bit more carbon-12 rich.
Because there has been this debate. There have been millions of people have watched videos about the Arctic methane threat. We have the Arctic Methane Emergency Group. We have the two Russian scientists who are warning about a seabed possibilities. And yet it seems that both you and Rob Jackson from Stanford Earth are, for now, ruling out the Arctic as a source of this increasing methane.
Not ruling out, but I was actually probably the first person to point out the Arctic problem. Papers I wrote in the Canadian Journal in the 1980s, and there was also somebody down in Scripps about the same time thinking about the same problem. I'm very aware of the Arctic, and we work in the Arctic a lot. We get samples from the Arctic all the time, and we've been flying in the Arctic. But you can say several things. First of all, overall, since this new growth started in 2007 and accelerating more recently, much of that has been led from the tropics. We have NOAA in particular have a global methane network, and you can see where the growth is strongest. And it's really the tropics and the subtropics, the northern subtropics and the equatorial, and to some extent the southern tropics as well. It's only 1 or 2 years, like 2007, where the Arctic has been leading. And even when the Arctic has led, it's looked like wind blowing from the northern forests. Secondly, we've been flying missions up in the Arctic. And when you pick up summer air there, that has the signature, the isotopic signature, this carbon-12-13 ratio, of northern wetlands. And when you backtrack the air, you pick it up as on your plane, and then you run the wind backwards and you find out where it's come from. And it's typically the Siberian wetland. Now, in the winter, if you fly missions in the Arctic, then the methane plumes, the enriched methane air, that you can fly through air that's richer in methane. Where's that coming from? And that enriched methane air has the carbon isotope ratio of Siberian gas fields, which are some of the world's biggest gas fields. So it looks like in the Arctic, the winter emissions are coming from the gas fields when everything's frozen. And in the summer, it's primarily coming from the wetlands. Now, there are emissions coming from permafrost sources and so on, but a lot of that actually goes through soil and gets eaten by methanotrophic bacteria. So the Arctic's a danger point, yes, bad one. And it's got big emissions. The northern forest, Canadian forest, and you know, a beaver is a monster methane machine. Beavers are absolutely wonderful, but they pull carbon into wetlands and then they make wetland. And wetland swamps, rotting vegetation makes methane. So the northern forests are making. But then you go to the tropics, and two things are happening here. First of all, there are a lot more people in the tropics, and people need food. And the world's cow superpower is India. The belt of moist Central Africa, I'm African, is very, very dependent on cattle for food, pasture lands, not arable lands. So the huge populations of cattle, and many of these areas like East Africa are getting warmer and wetter. A cow is basically a walking wetland. The cow's tummy is a wetland. Then the natural wetlands, and they're huge ones in Amazonia and in the Congo drainage, the Nile drainage, and in the Zambezi drainage. Very, very big wetlands. We've been flying over these wetlands and seeing really huge emissions. One example is the Bangweulu wetlands, which you've probably never heard of. Oh. But me going to school in Zimbabwe, Bangweulu was where we always wanted to go. It was in the north of our then federation. It's where David Livingstone died, who was Zambia's national hero. It's also where the First World War ended, which you probably don't know. It took a long time for the German army, and they were attacking Lusaka in Zambia, to realize that the war had ended in Flanders. So, they'd better lay down their arms in Zambia. So Bangweulu is important. But the Bangweulu wetlands emit nearly as much methane as Britain. In Bolivia and Amazonia, there's some wetlands in northeastern Bolivia. They probably emit more, and we've been flying planes over that as well. We borrowed the British Antarctic Survey's planes, one of their planes, the Tornata, as it was flying up to Calgary to get serviced. And we measured these huge emissions there. So it's important.
As you point out in the Philosophical Transactions paper, the tropical nations are not simply bystanders, as they are largely for CO2. But is there anything really that those nations can do to control these very large sources?
I need to be very careful because, I'm African, I have Indian relatives, I know how important cattle are. They're culturally important and they're vital for food. It's really, really central. But you can do a great deal in the tropics. Methane is rather different from CO2. In CO2, it's fairly straightforward what the problems are. It's basically the richer nations, and I'm including China in this, which is nowadays a developed nation. And of course, China is the biggest emitter, India the second biggest. So in CO2, it's really very obvious that we need to do things about the coal industry, and we need to do things about the oil and gas industry as well. In methane, much more subtle. A lot of it is, and particularly the recent growth is coming from the tropics. It includes food as well as energy. So energy is important. Gas emissions are well over 100 million tons or energy emissions, but agriculture probably emits more. What can you do? Here's somewhere where the tropical countries can buy in. Now, for most tropical countries that I've been to, and I've been to most of them probably, cattle are very, very important culturally, as well as in food production. I have Indian relatives. I know how central cattle are. They feed India. Huge amounts of India's food come from pasture land. Cattle in Africa, Central Africa, are absolutely vital. And that, again, is from pasture land. If you try to persuade Africa to go vegan, they've got to abandon their pasture land and then intensify their agriculture and probably cut down a lot more forest. That's not a sensible way to go forward. What you can do, though, and what really struck us in our flights over Africa, is you can tackle a lot of much simpler things. First of all, there's very, very widespread fires. And both in India and Africa, there's intense air pollution from burning crop waste. Now, here, I'm in Britain now. Even in Britain in the 1970s and 80s, there was incredible air pollution from crop waste fires. You know, when you've cut down your, harvested your maize or whatever you've done, you have all the rest of it, the maize stalks and so on. What do you do with it? Well, in Africa, you burn it. And then you get incomplete combustion. You make a great deal of methane and you make an enormous amount of air pollution. Your soil nutrients go up into smoke. That smoke rises 5,000-6,000 feet, a couple of thousand meters. It gets entrained in the winds, and it winds up in a thunderstorm in the
North Atlantic or the South Atlantic, depending on where you are in Africa. It feeds a lot of happy fish because the nutrients come down and they feed the fish. Or if you're the world is a bit luckier, it goes across to Amazonia and fertilizes Amazonia. Africa loses. So we need to do something about crop waste fires. India is trying very hard to reduce fires for air pollution reasons. And there are lots of things you can do. At the very least, you can actually do what they do in Britain and just burn it into electricity. These are things you can do. So crop waste fires are a good start. Another thing you can do, all over Africa now, they're gigantic new cities with cities like Kinshasa and Lagos are some of the biggest on the planet. And many of the new cities in Africa, and I'm not going to name any of them, have enormous, what you would probably call a landfill in Canada. I would just call it a dump, where you dump everything. Many of these are burning. They have huge emission plumes on them. All you need to do is put a few centimeters of soil on top. That's not high tech. Yeah, in the UK, they've reduced landfill methane emissions tremendously by high-tech stuff, putting pipes in, and they actually burn off the methane. Landfills make methane. In the UK, they burn it all off and turn it into electricity. Well, that's great, and it's cheaper than buying oil or coal from somebody else. But in Africa, they just many African countries, they just let it burn. And, of course, that causes, again, air pollution, big methane emissions. The simple answer is put some soil over. A slightly more complex answer is to pipe out the methane and turn it into electricity. So just by tackling landfills, tackling crop waste fires, doing that sort of thing, you can really make a good starting point on your methane emissions. The other really big thing we can do is cut the fossil fuels, which is what many countries are trying to do. At least cut the emissions from the fossil fuels, even if you don't cut the fossil fuels. I would obviously like to do both. And there we're being helped tremendously by technology, particularly in the gas industry, which is actually very smart. And their leaks are money. You know, you leak your gas, your profit goes up. I think it's hard to tell, but even in for example, US frackers, some of the frackers were releasing 9-10% of their gas. Well, you know, that's crazy. The technology is getting so much better for detecting gas leaks that I think there's very, very strong pressure on the gas industry to reduce emissions. The oil industry flares, in many places, flares or just vents gas. I know in parts of Canada where you get fairly heavy oil, they just vent the gas, or they used to. Now, obviously, legislation in Canada is doing things about that. But there are wide parts of the world where flaring is still pervasive, and you don't flare the whole thing. Methane comes off. And I've flown over Africa at night again and again, seen these huge flares, which just seem immensely wasteful. And then finally, there's the coal industry. And coal emits methane at pretty much all stages in the mine, where it's very dangerous and blows up mines. It's vented then by ventilation shafts from mines. Now, you can actually remove the methane in the air from the ventilation shafts. And that you can do by simple chemistry. You can also shut down the coal industry, which I'd love to do. But I'm well aware how important that is. South Africa has enormous employment from the coal industry. And it needs to shut down its coal industry. It causes pollution. It's very, very damaging to an agriculturally fragile area. But it's going to take a generation to shut down the coal industry. Even here in the UK, in Scotland, they're still yelling about Margaret Thatcher shutting the coal industry in the 1980s. You know, it's immensely difficult socially. Or the other things you can do, which I think in the near future we'll be able to do, and that's actually removing methane from particular places. And for example, in the dairy industry, or in dairy farms where you, in part of the season, you bring the cows into barns. You know, in the cold countries, you do that in the winter. In other countries, you may do it in the dry season. We've been measuring methane in barns, and it gets up to 100 or 200 parts per million, whereas ambient air is 2 parts per million, or 1.9 parts per million. And at 100 to 200 parts per million, that's a target for removal. If you can, it's quite likely we can actually develop the technology to just pump out the air and then remove the methane. You've got to be careful. So if you spend a lot of energy removing the methane, then you're emitting CO2 somewhere else.
On Radio EcoShock, you are listening to Professor Ewan Nisbet explaining why the intense global warming gas methane is rising and what could be done. Follow up at our website at ecoshock.org.
Well, there are some serious scientists at work at this. Rob Jackson, he's the chair of the Global Carbon Project. And, of course, you've got the former chief scientist, Sir David King, with the Center for Climate Repair at Cambridge. They're working toward some sort of technology to remove methane. They'd like to go right back to pre-industrial levels if they could. They think it's that serious that it's escalating.
It's a very tough call here. Removing methane from ambient air is, I don't think, on. You would use so much energy. If you're going to use that energy, it would be far better to just replace coal mining and not generate the energy in the first place. However, if you locally have energy from, say, solar or wind sources, and you can't just use that to displace CO2 emission from some coal-burning power station, then if the methane's about 100 part per million in the air, in other words, in a concentrated place like a cattle barn, then it may well be worth removing it. You can remove it by lots of different processes. The very simplest is just have some very bright sunlight and titanium dioxide paint. Paint your roof white somewhere in the tropics, and that will remove a little bit of methane. And so that's very low energy. But more high energy is if you heat the air up to couple of hundred degrees and or several hundred degrees and pass it over an iron oxide, that removes. However, it's a bit crazy to heat air to stop global warming, if you think about it. The global warming is all about heating air. In other words, it's inefficient. So there's some very complex trade-offs here. But where there's a lot of methane in the air, it's probably worth doing if you've got a cheap non-greenhouse electricity close by. And for example, on a farm, you could have a wind turbine or something close by your cattle barn or solar power on the roof. And there you could probably remove quite a bit of the methane locally. You could certainly do that from, say, a manure tank or something like that, where there's much higher amounts of methane there. And there are lots of different technologies. I think this is going to come. And it's applicable particularly in heavily populated areas.
When I hear people talking about methane restoration or handling methane, they talk about, well, we'll oxidize it, we'll break it down into carbon dioxide, and that sort of alleviates the problem. But, you know, just as beginners, we think, well, that's more carbon dioxide. You're just going to add more greenhouse gases. How does that work out?
Well, it depends on your time of reference. If you're thinking over a million years, that's true. But methane is a much, much stronger greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. Methane naturally lasts in the air for what's called its replacement time, so it's a bit over 9 years, in which methane gets in the air and then a series of reactions involving sunlight. And if you take water, is H2O, H-O-H, knock off a light reaction, knocks off an H, and there you've got OH. What happens if you're an OH floating around the air? You're a bit hungry and you see somebody with some hydrogen. That's methane, CH4. So you grab a hydrogen. And so what OH does is it oxidizes the methane to CO2. Over a decade or so, the methane is oxidized. But over the short time that it's methane, it's a very powerful warmer. much more powerful than CO2. That means that over these short periods, and for example, if you take the time period of the Paris Agreement, which Rob Jackson and Stanford University has been arguing is actually the time period we should think of, then methane really is important. It's sort of a bit over half the importance of CO2 in the amount of warming it's delivered since 1750, which is pretty important. And it's been sort of neglected because everyone thought, oh, well, let's forget about methane. Let's worry about CO2. So it's far better in terms of our short time scale, which we're worried about, the next decades, the next century. It's far better to oxidize that methane to CO2, where it's a lesser problem. It's still a problem, but it's far less a problem. So if you can oxidize the methane to CO2, that's a winner.
So we're in a methane emergency. What do you make of the global methane pledge signed by some countries at the COP26 talks in Scotland?
I think it's enormously important. It's a real step forwards. It's going to do something. First of all, the good side to it is that it commits a large number of countries, including a lot of tropical countries, to do their best about this. If you look back to the Montreal Protocol on ozone, the initial protocol was pretty weak. Yeah, it was a statement of intention. And then a bit later, and I'm going to mention here somebody called Sir Crispin Tickell, who's just died, his funeral's this week. He was very important because he talked to Margaret Thatcher, the UK Prime Minister at the time, she was a good scientist. And she sat down, I was told, and read the papers. She understood the papers. And then she went and persuaded Ronald Reagan and George Bush the first that they were going to do this. And the result of that was the second, what was called the London Amendment, and then there was one in Copenhagen as well. And they made the ozone treaty work. I think the Global Methane Pledge is the same sort of thing. At the moment, it's really a statement of intent. But then a few layers later, if it's going to follow the ozone treaty, you'll get some real hard teeth into it. And the ozone treaty has worked. It's been the best thing we've done, not just for ozone, but for the greenhouse, because these gases are also very important greenhouse gases. So I see the methane pledge as a sign of hope for the future. Now, the countries that didn't join are very important countries. There's China, India, Australia, huge coal mining countries, South Africa.
Russia didn't join either, I don't think.
And Russia, yeah. These are enormously important countries. But if you look at the ozone treaty, initially there was not much support from India and China either. And luckily, George Bush and Thatcher got together, and Tickell was on the UN Security Council. He got on extremely well with the other permanent members. They used to go and have meals at his with him regularly. And they got together, and they did something about it. And they realized it was important. In China and India's interests, these are probably the countries that will suffer most from climate change. Very big populations. In many parts of them, they've got areas which will suffer a lot from very slight changes in climate. It's very much in their interests. India, what can they do? They can stop crop burning. Good starter. Now, that's easy. They do need to shut down their coal industry. It's enormous employment. It's going to take decades. But they're already getting to a situation where their coal-fired power is more expensive than alternatives. So it's becoming a stranded asset. That's true in China as well. Coal is becoming a stranded asset. China's trying to switch to natural gas, which is why gas prices are rising all over the place. You know, China has really enormous problems, but it's very much in China's interest to cut the methane emissions. And they can do that by tackling landfills, big landfills in India and China, which are emitting an awful lot. It can easily be tackled by tackling the small things. Do the small things first.
But there was a 2020 paper by Rob Jackson, and PEP Canada was involved in it, and they found that we are, with this methane, on track to hit 4.5 degrees C by the end of the century, and that means 10-year-olds today could experience some sort of climate catastrophe. You know, you're talking about processes that will take decades, and that is realistic. I've been to some of these countries. I know what you're talking about. But do you think we have that time? Is methane going to give us that time?
Martin Manning, who's in New Zealand, in a paper that I was involved in, pointed out actually that methane is the gas that's most divergent from the expectation of the Paris Agreement. That's partly just the function of economic downturns and COVID shocks and so on CO2. But methane, of all of the greenhouse gases, is the one that's most divergent from what was hoped for in Paris. I think in the short term, by short term I mean 5 to 10 years, we can make a fairly hefty dent in emissions by taking things like landfill and crop fires and vents from coal mines and so on, and stopping gas leaks. And the gas industry is actually trying very hard. So over the next 10 years, I think we can make a pretty hefty dent in the methane budget just by tackling those things. Over 20 years, this is when we really need to get to grips with coal mining. And that's obviously going to be complex and very difficult for the coal mining countries. But I think we can do, and I think that shift is going to be hastened by things like solar and wind power getting cheaper, and by battery technology and energy storage getting better, and also by the shift to electric cars, which is, automatically brings you a lot of batteries as well, which you can use for energy storage. I think cars are going to be more than just cars. I think they're also going to help with your home electricity quite soon. You know, you charge up at midnight when there's a lot of wind around in Britain, in the North Sea, and then you discharge, if you're not taking your car out that day, you'll just discharge from your car into your house and run your tumble dryer in the daytime. That sort of thing's going to happen. We're going to be much more sophisticated. I'm actually very hopeful that within about a couple of decades, we can probably bring methane down. Methane emissions are roughly 600 million tons a year. We can probably bring that down to 500 million tons, maybe within a decade or so, maybe down to 400 million tons in 25 years. I think that is doable. We're helped by the fact that the lifetime's about a bit over 9 years, so that our past sins are forgiven because that's destroyed by the sun. We've just got to stop sinning right now. Unlike CO2, where your past sins pile up and you've got a much more difficult problem. So let's tackle the methane problem without forgetting about the CO2 problem, which is the long-term problem.
From Royal Holloway University in London, we have been speaking with world methane expert Professor Ewan Nisbet. I will post links to follow up on this key science in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Ewan Nisbet, thank you for sharing your valuable time with our listeners.
Well, thanks a lot. It's been very good talking to you.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.